Back at it for you Tuesday, July 28th, right here on Connecticut Today. A contentious police reform bill being debated by the General Assembly. We got differing viewpoints on that. Democrat Steve Stafstrom, state rep from Bridgeport, and the House chair, the co-chair of the Judiciary Committee, joined us to talk about that in the 4 o'clock hour. In the 5 o'clock hour, we heard about the same bill from Fairfield GOP State Senator Tony Wong. Right now, the gentleman who we've had on a couple of times here is the build-up and the momentum toward the police accountability or police reform bill has been building. State Rep. Steve Stafstrom, Democrat from Bridgeport, and also the senior Democrat in the House on the Judiciary Committee that helped draft this bill. Steve, how are you? Are you all rested up since you pulled that all-nighter last week?
Yeah, got a little sleep over the weekend, caught up with the kids, and thanks for having me back on.
Did they remember who you were? Daddy's home after
a little time at Seaside Park. We were good.
Oh, that's good. That's always good. Okay, Steve, let's get down to this because there's been so much said about this by me, other people, and frankly, a lot of people that are that want a little better explanation here. Let's get right to the nitty gritty because there's a lot of stuff in the bill. Obviously, everybody agrees on the body cams, which I'm 100% in favor of, better accountability. Let's get to the qualified immunity thing.
Yep.
What if you can just, just explain to my audience from a legal point of view, because people may know or may not know, you are an attorney. What changes, if any, does the bill actually make to what we had in Connecticut from qualified immunity to what the bill would do if the Senate passes it?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. And this is the key question. I'm really glad you brought this up because there is a lot of confusion and I would say even misinformation out there because this provision of the bill went through various drafts before the bill that actually passed. So the change is very limited. It's a minor change, and I want to dispel the notion that folks have that we are eliminating qualified immunity as a defense for officers. We are not. That's not what this bill does. That's not what I'm advocating. That's not what most of my caucus and members of the Judiciary Committee are advocating. This is a relatively minor change that would say an officer or not even really the officer, the town could be sued where an officer violates somebody's constitutional rights. So remember, we're talking about an actual violation of somebody's constitutional rights, and the officer does that without a good faith belief that they were complying with the law when they did it. And then, even in those instances, the only time the officer would face any sort of liability or, this whole argument that, officers will lose their house, the only time an officer faces any liability at all is when they maliciously or willfully violate somebody's constitutional rights without a good faith belief to comply with the law. So you are talking the most egregious of egregious cases where that would take root.
Okay, so if this passes, then, Steve, a town attorney, for example, or some lawyer that was retained here, or maybe some level of jurisprudence, they would have the ability to say, hey, wait a minute, okay, you may not have liked what officer so-and-so did to you in this arrest or this motor vehicle stop, but as you say, this is limited to what would be an egregious violation of constitutional rights. You wouldn't have, and I hate to use the term, Steve, but I'm going to because I'm sure you may have heard it, you wouldn't have ambulance chasing here by some attorneys?
Yeah, no. I mean, what you're talking about and the way this plays out is if you allege an officer violated your constitutional rights, whatever that may be, they unlawfully retained you, they beat you up, whatever you're claiming is, you file that lawsuit. The town attorney or the insurance company for the town is going to provide a defense for the officer. They're going to provide a lawyer. They're going to have to pay for it. And that attorney is then going to say, wait a second. We arrested that guy. We did whatever to him. But the officer had a good faith belief they were following the law when they did that. If a judge agrees, then the case is going to be dismissed right from the outset. Okay. The case is, it's not, you're not going to go through all sorts of crazy discovery. You're not going to get in front of a runaway jury. It's like, it's, the case will be dismissed at that early stage. If the case is not, and it goes on to trial, then at trial, the plaintiff, the person bringing the lawsuit, has the burden of proof to establish that, in fact, that officer violated somebody's constitutional rights and didn't have a good faith belief they were complying with the law. Even then, the town is going to be the one to pick up whatever damages, whatever, you know, amount is claimed by the plaintiff. And only if a jury finds that the officer's actions were willful and wanton, you know, think of the George Floyd incident, those would be the only cases in which the officer would be on the hook for legal liability. And frankly, that's already federal law. In those instances, a police officer could already be subject to having to pay for those damages under existing federal law.
So what is, so you've just kind of, what would you say, Steve, you've tweaked things here, you've broadened things a little bit, you've cut out a different path on this.
Yeah,
how would you categorize
so
that?
What we've done is, I would categorize it as, we're going back to the way qualified immunity was intended when it was created in the 1960s as a defense. In the 1990s and into the 1990s, the U.S. Supreme Court has really restricted the doctrine to the point where you have instances where, unless there's what's called a clearly established legal violation, and what that has been interpreted as is another case that flows from these body of case law, that the case can't proceed even onto a jury. So there's a pretty famous case where an officer stole $250,000 from somebody's house as part of a search of the residence, and he was ended up getting the case dismissed against him because the appellate court said, well, it's not clearly established from a prior case that you can't steal from somebody's house when doing a search of it. So we'll make that the case going forward, but for now, we can't hold them liable for it. It's become an unworkable doctrine, and we're trying to go back to what it was originally intended as in the 1960s before, I would argue, kind of runaway courts have kind of legislated this doctrine into oblivion.
All right, Steve, hang on. We'll be right back with you. State Rep. Steve Stafstrom joins us. He was one of the architects of the police reform bill that's going through the motions right now in the Senate. Steve, hang on. Traffic and weather together coming up right here on WICC. At 440, 441, 203, 333, 9422, 333, WICC, Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Steve Stafstrom spending some time with us trying to, explain a little bit more about this change to qualified immunity in the state for the state's local police officers. So, Steve, getting back to what we were talking about, if a police officer called this show right now and said, Representative Stafstrom, is there now a reason I should go out and get liability insurance moving forward if this bill is approved? What would you tell them?
So I think it's always worth exploring stuff like that. I don't think it's necessary. Obviously a lot of professionals have liability insurance, be that a doctor, I have it as a lawyer, accountants have it. Certainly it's always worth something exploring, but I don't think this bill puts any additional liability on an officer because they are, as I said, they're entitled to defense and indemnification from their town, except for in those actual willful, malicious instances. And even then, an officer is already on the hook for that under existing federal law. So, maybe it's the lawyer in me. I would always say, sure, it's worth exploring, but I don't think they should do it because of this bill. I think this bill really doesn't change anything for them in terms of their potential liability.
Well, it's funny you mentioned, or apropos, you mentioned the lawyer in you, because you're a lawyer. I have dear friends who are lawyers. I have lawyers in the family. I've had lawyers draw up, legal documents for my family. They've done wonderful jobs. But are you at all concerned that there is wiggle room in this language, Steve, where some lawyers are going to say, this wasn't a civil rights violation, but screw it. Let's file the lawsuit and make the town squirm a little. Yes or no?
You know, possibly, but I think there's ways for us to deal with that. Number one, this law doesn't even become effective until a year from now. So we're going to continue to study and look at the language. Certainly, we're going to work with insurance companies for the town and defense lawyers. I do mostly defense work myself, quite frankly, on what the actual ramifications of this are going to be. And we can make tweaks to it as we go forward. And you know, this certainly is not a rigid, this is the end of it, this is the end of the conversation. And we've tried to make that clear to certainly to the opponents of this legislation as we've worked through this process.
Are you surprised at all the pushback this has gotten from law enforcement, Steve? I mean, all over the state, you've got from police chiefs on down, it's not even, Steve, you know, rank and file officers or rookie or veteran officers, or is that because they don't know the details?
I think there's a part of it that folks just are not understanding the details. I think, unfortunately, there is some misinformation being spread. I think there is partisan politics that is playing into this, given it's an election year and the like. I think there's some internal fighting going on between these various organizations that are the unions for the officers and trying to make power plays. There's a lot of other things, I think, going into this. And I do feel bad for the rank and file officer because I do think they are being misled and are not not understanding sort of what this legislation is getting at and what the actual impact on a day-to-day basis is going to be for them. And that is unfortunate because, you know, certainly we do value greatly the service and the sacrifice our officers make every day, particularly, you know, in a city like Bridgeport here. And, you know, they do need to be supported and protected. And that's why we've worked diligently over the last several weeks to try to refine and craft this legislation to deal with the major concerns we've heard. And as this process has unfolded, be it on qualified immunity, be it on the use of force, be it on, you know, collective bargaining issues, on FOIA, on access to mental health, there's any number of on pensions, there's any number of issues that came up in the drafting of this bill that we either toned down or took out of this bill because of pushback and concern from rank and file officers. And I think, unfortunately, this qualified immunity piece remains kind of the one issue where you're hearing kind of the loudest pushback, and you know we're working to address that.
Finally, Steve, a lot of folks know by now that an amendment to remove this from the bill failed on a tie, so it came within one vote, a yes vote, of removing this completely from the bill. Yet your caucus then voted overwhelmingly for it. There were a few defections. There's still a little grumbling. How do you account for the disparity or the change or the dynamic here of it almost being removed with some Democrats doing that versus then passing with a pretty comfortable margin? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, because I think folks are looking at kind of one section of a 45-section bill, and there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of really good things in this bill, be it additional training, be it increases in minority recruitment, giving police departments greater ability to fire the bad apples within the department, more civilian oversight. As you mentioned, the body camera and dashboard funding, you know, independent investigations of deadly force. There's a lot of things in this bill people support and people support wholeheartedly. I think that one section on qualified immunity kind of became the subject of the conversation and where most of the pushback was. And like I said, one of the compromises we struck was pushing the enactment date of that section out until next June, after next legislative session. So to the extent there's additional study and analysis and tweaks to the language that need to be made with respect to that language, we have all of next legislative session to do that, and I fully expect us to continue to discuss that issue. So I think there was enough comfort in my caucus, even with the failure of that amendment, to say, you know what, let's not let all of this good stuff go down because there's one issue that needs further discussion, especially when there's a mechanism in place to continue that discussion.
All right, Steve, thanks. We appreciate it. Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Steve Staffstrom. Steve, one of the chief architects of the police reform bill that's going through the state Senate as we speak right now. Steve, thank you. Stay in touch.
Take care, Paul.
All right, folks, so you're a station friend of the program here, State Senator Republican Fairfield. Tony, how are you?
I'm good, Paul. How are you? I hope you don't mind a little bit of the echo. I'm calling you from the rotunda of the Capitol.
Tony, this will bathe your phone call in all kinds of nutmeg state history. Can I tell you that? Is that all right?
Why so? It's a pretty empty place so far right now. You know, we only have legislators and essential staff on board, yeah. And the social distancing protocols are strictly adhered to. It is unlike any, session that I've ever participated in, but it is important in respecting the current crisis, the COVID pandemic that we're in.
Sure.
But nevertheless, it's work is being done. In fact, we just finished voting on the telehealth. And so we have actually done three bills already.
Okay.
Today, the absentee ballot,
yeah,
as well as the insulin cap.
But the fun is yet to come. A couple of minutes ago, for about 20 minutes, I had one of your compadres, Steve Staffstrom from Bridgeport, on the show, who, of course, obviously, you know this, Tony, but for people who don't, he was one of the chief architects of this bill, the senior House Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. And I asked him, Tony, to just, if he could, in plain English, delineate what changes, if anything, are being made to the qualified immunity for police officers? And I'm not setting this up as a you versus him, but it was Steve's contention that this was just a tweaking of what qualified immunity originally was, and there will still be plenty of built-in legal protections for officers, many of whom, Tony, you know, are reacting with anger at this and some worry. What are your thoughts on this whole thing?
Well, I want to applaud Representative Staffstrom, Representative Bendis, Senator Winfield, Senator Kissel, who worked as part of the leadership in this important bill, which was brought on obviously by the George Floyd tragedy and criminal act, and along with many other need for social justice reform. So I know it's important. It's the rush of the moment. But what we have learned from the public hearing that occurred for 20 hours, the listening, and then the process that occurred in the House, that so little of this bill is understood and so little of it has been truly vetted. And it really is a significant problem that as you delve more into it, the statement of saying these are tweaking have had dramatic impact. These I'm not a lawyer, so okay. For me, I've read it from a policy standpoint. I got to be honest with you. That simple tweaking in the eyes of a possible attorney may be one thing, but in the eyes of law enforcement that put their lives and public safety on the line every single day, it is earth-shaking mm-hmm. statements of impact and a chilling effect as well, Paul.
Yeah, and you know, I wonder, Tony, and part of the concern here, and Steve and I had a good discussion about this, part of the concern here, Tony, you probably heard it from, you know, the cities and towns in your district and in Fairfield and the surrounding area, is that there are mayors, first select men, first select women, town managers, all this, who are wondering now, well, wait a minute, how does this affect my overall town liability? Do we have to buy more liability coverage? Do we have to set aside more in our budgets for this? What do we tell our police commission? What do we tell the police chief to tell the officers? That was my, and we got into a good discussion with Steve, that was my issue as to how do we know how this thing is going to shake out?
Well, make no mistake about it. A criminal act by law enforcement is never immune to prosecution. And the incumbency and the urgency of towns to ensure proper training, ensure proper procedures are critical. So the idea that the increased liability opens a door from the potential, not just, you know, you hear people say that this bill is not going to hurt good cops. And the reality is, in speaking to so many of law enforcement officials, the reality is the chilling effect of not simply looking at the bad cops, but the reality of doing your day-to-day job, the process of split-second decision-making is now significantly undermined, that no officer in their own right mind wants to possibly put their career and their reputation at risk. This bill in its current language opens the door for significant repercussions in regards to constitutional violations. It's as broad as our First Amendment. The reality is individuals now can be sued, and it is not through a process of the post and police officer training and organizations. It is now going to be decided in a court of judicial law. We have taken away the practice of law enforcement on the streets and split-second process and decision in public safety and moved it to the judicial court system, and the possibility of putting people's career, reputation, personal livelihood, and income at risk. So for attorneys and legislators to say and advocates to say this is a small tweaking, they have obviously not heard the people that are out working and putting themselves in the front line and what they perceive to be a significant chilling effect to doing their job, which is first and foremost protecting and the safety and lives of everyone that they're sworn to protect.
Now, one thing, Tony, and the guest is Tony Wong, one thing Steve did mention to me that I don't think a lot of people realize, Tony, is this does not kick in right away. There's a several-month wait here, I guess, Tony, to get more. I mean, it'll be passed, obviously, if there's the votes there, but I did not know that there's a – this section of the bill does not kick in right away. There will be several months where I guess this can still be – looked at or debated, not in the sense of a legislative debate, but debated among pros and cons of this. So at least, you know, there's some sort of cushion here, I would think, before this kicks in on what, June 1 or July 1 of next year? Is that what it is?
Paul, literally a year from now.
Okay.
July 1, 2021, which begs the question, why the sense of urgency? Why in the middle of a COVID pandemic crisis where our logistics are so unusual that we don't have a fully vetted public hearing that shareholders from all perspectives and sides have a chance to offer their viewpoint? Maybe for me, the idea of why we're doing this in convening a special session when we have a whole year to deliberate and do the right thing and not have the issues of the chilling effect and all the legal implications that are now saying, quote, we are going to tweak it. That's not good policy making, particularly when we have time to be able to manage this. I find that to be incredulous in the sense that why are we here forcing these special considerations for us to cast votes on a bill that won't take effect when we haven't had the complete due process? Are we swayed by the emotion of trying to get something done, no matter how tweaking or possibly legally ramification-wise illegal or unconstitutional? Mm-hmm. It's bad policymaking. It's trying to just say we did something, but we'll fix it later.
Who's going to watch, or Tony, who will – do you think there will be any – how should I put this? Will there be any effort to take a further look at this? As you say, there will be a year. So what can be done short of a bill to refine this or change it even further or get rid of it, which is highly unlikely? What actually can members of a General Assembly do, especially after an election of something like this that's passed – but doesn't take effect for a year? I'm trying to think if there was ever anything in my mind in this state that happened that way, and I can't think of one.
I can't either. and to be so comprehensive and widely impactful. That is why I struggle with this, is the fact that we can do a far, far better job. And maybe for me, my experience was the comprehensive gun bill that we went through the process post-Sandy Hook tragedy. And that happened in December. We came back into session in January. We had town halls. We had public hearings. We had input from all circles and impact of people who were for, against, legal scholars, psychological scholars. We had everybody provide feedback. And we crafted the bill that had something that people liked and something that people didn't like. But we took 4 to 5 months of real comprehensive analysis to craft a bill that was so emotionally raw. But we came out with something that everybody had a say in. Right now, there's a significant group that doesn't feel like they have a say. And they're the most important one in some ways because they're out on the front lines. And even though you say this is not happening a year from now, the chilling effect has already been felt. I have heard from so many law enforcement, from young career officers to experienced officers, the fact that they're thinking about a different career. The experienced officers are looking to retire. We already have declining recruitment of law enforcement. It's such a critical time, Paul, when we need to get the best and the brightest to join that field so that we can create a new environment, a new thought process of police reform and accountability. This is really just putting ice on the whole process rather than helping it, in my opinion. I think I would encourage the governor to possibly veto this and say, come back and do the work that is right, process-oriented, and accounts for all the input to get the best bill that we can, rather than saying, simply put, this is a majority vote, and we're going to push it through, and that we're simply making tweakings of it. But tweaking has significant impact, particularly when it comes to public safety. The fact is, I just don't want this to have unintended consequences that impact our community's public safety and our ability for frontline law enforcement at all levels to not be able to do their job without looking over their shoulder. If you talk to them, you understand the weight and the pressure that they're under every day. Now they not only have just the job, they're going to have to worry about legal proceedings at every turn that they do things.
Tony, thank you. Good luck tonight. I know it'll probably be a long night, so stay in touch. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Always appreciate being on with you, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Tony Wong there, Republican State Senator Fairfield.
It's a little ironic that, you know, just about as we speak, the state Senate is following up on what it did by instituting telehealth and making that standard in terms of what we're doing around the state. The ability with telehealth to be able to get a really good diagnosis remotely saves a lot of time, saves a lot of money, makes it easier for us to provide critical health care. And it's just one reminder to me how COVID has changed this state forever. Telehealth, telecommuting, I can tell you, Mayor, I mean, the phones are ringing off the hook. The number of people around the country, around the region, New York City, taking a new look at Connecticut, realizing that this is just an amazing lifestyle, pretty safe, not a bad place if you have to quarantine, to have a little backyard, and an amazing education system, doctor, and people recognize that, and another reason people want to come back to the state of Connecticut. And so what my friend Nick Simmons over here and our team have been, you know, putting together is not just how we prepare for this fall when a fair number of students maybe don't feel comfortable coming back into the school. We have to find an alternate way for them to stay active in education. But also we're making one of the biggest commitments in the country to technology for students anywhere, $43 million, because Dr. Ruffin, as I said, you know, it's not just about this next semester. I think it's about how we change education going forward. As you probably remember, I got some good news for you, I think. which is we've done a survey of all the different school districts around the state. It looks like right now about 75% of the students and the faculty really want to get back into the classroom, as long as we can show them that we're doing it safely. But just as importantly, 25% don't feel comfortable of those students getting back into the classroom right now. And we got to make sure that they do not get left behind. So that's what our commitment is. It started this summer. You maybe remember the partnership led by the Dalio Foundation, bought 60,000 Chromebooks, got those distributed to kids in need so we could start the learning in a new way after, sadly, we had to close down the schools due to COVID back during the spring. And what we're announcing today is we're acquiring another 50,000 Chromebooks, really focused on those kids in need, focused on the Alliance districts, getting them up and operating, hopefully in time for the new school year, so that for those kids in particular that don't feel comfortable coming back into the classroom, their learning doesn't stop. Obviously, it takes more than a Chromebook to make education come to life. So we're going to be training people here on campus, having instructors around to help families and kids in terms of how to use the services. We have a number of online scholastic relationships going forward. Nick has put together relationships with all the major cable operators. Because one of the things we found out, and I'm afraid we found out here in Waterbury, as well as a lot of other cities, Mayor O'Leary, is that 20 to 30% of the kids just didn't have access to very good internet access. And they weren't able to take advantage of the online learning that was available this spring. So we've worked with the cable guys, which I was one some years ago, to make sure that we can provide hotspots and cable access to 200 different hotspots around this state, so that at the community center, the library, or the park, we'll be able to designate where that is. You can go out there with your new Chromebook and continue your education in a very different way. In addition, we've negotiated a very low-cost lifeline rate, which we'll be paying for the next year, again, to get internet access to those kids in locations where they otherwise wouldn't be able to do it. And, to me, this is the Brown v. Board of Education of our generation. The separate but equal back in the 50s is the digital divide of the 21st century. And I have spent a fair amount of my life thinking about IT and how we can expand access and expand education and bring the world closer to our students. And so it's on a personal note as well. I like the commitment that we're able to make, not just that it was prompted by this COVID reality that we have to deal with, but how it's going to change our state and change education forever. And now we just got to make sure that kids take full advantage of this. We can get the box, we can get the IT, we can get the wires in there. We got to get the teachers better, engaged in how we do this. And I'm really hopeful that a lot of the online learning is still electronically into the classroom. Through Zoom, that student will still be able to touch base with his or her friends and look a teacher in the eye. So it's about the academics, but it's also about the social and emotional learning. And we're going to find a way to technology to help bridge the gap. At the end of the day, nothing's going to ever replace an amazing building, an amazing classroom experience like this. We're going to do everything we can to build around that. And that's what this commitment is all about today. Thanks for inviting me, everybody.